You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a broadcaster, and an all-round gastronaut. First of all, I want to talk to Antoine Hubert, chairman and CEO of insect farming startup Yinsect. Hello there, Antoine.
Hi, Stephen.
Now, Antoine, there are various different sectors that have become really important to the insect industry, and sports nutrition is one of them. And I think, to begin with, I was quite surprised at this. Why has sports nutrition embraced entomophagy?
I think we worked a lot on animal nutrition and plant nutrition, and we found that what we bring as a value for customers is about performance and health. Performance benefits, nutritional benefits, and health benefits. So we were thinking, what would that mean for human food? And we found that health is about the cholesterol reduction. We found it's also about highly digestible products for elderly people. They have some disease called sarcopenia, very old, and they cannot digest any more proteins, and they need this kind of protein supplements there. And for performance, it's about muscle performance. So we found really quickly that the sport nutrition was really echoing very well what we were bringing to as marketing and science and benefits to animals and plants. And it was also echoing to what we understand for the market. We have seen some companies in Europe, in the US also starting a few years ago to investigate the sport nutrition with some good feedback. And we have done some marketing research on thousands of young people in Europe, in France, UK, or in Germany. We see that people in large metropolitan areas, they are trying to be healthy and fit. They do sports regularly, but they're also looking for healthy snacks, especially in the UK, not even if they are not really doing a lot of sports, but for at 10 o'clock or at 4 p.m. in the afternoon, having some small break in cereal bars, energy bars. And they see maybe the way of, again, milk proteins are not the most sustainable product they will have, and they are looking for something as digestible and more sustainable. And this is what we've proven. And we have done this research with the Maastricht University in Netherlands, really showing that the product in vivo in the body on real humans is as good as milk in terms of absorptions and metabolism. And I would say sustainability benefits have been proven for different life cycle assessments, showing a strong reduction of carbon emissions. And we know we are between 0.5 and 1 kilo of CO2 per kilo of proteins compared to few kilos for milk and 20 to 30 kilos of CO2 per kilos of beef meat. Mm. So we have something really highly sustainable without also including the offset of emissions we have with the organic fertilizer going back to the soil, which is a long-term sequestration of carbon, which is offsetting part of our emissions. Mm. So altogether, we see that there were a good value proposal for sports nutrition and a good reception also from the consumers, but it's only the beginning. Again, it's now accelerating with the green light in Europe, the first official green light for an insect product a few weeks ago, allowing the mealworm we are farming as approved for human food. So this is now accelerating, giving visibility to customers, and they want to test it more and more. So in the next 2 years, it will grow a lot, I'm sure, in Europe, and will follow in the US.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're referring a lot to the protein and how it works inside the body. Do you see yourself as an insect company or a protein company?
We see ourselves as an ingredient company, an ingredient company for various applications. And it's actually coming from insects. But what we are here to show, it's made the ingredients. They have performance benefits, nutrition benefits, health benefits, sustainability benefits. And okay, by the way, it's coming from insects.
Yeah.
But what matters is the final product, and what is embedded is the product.
And do you feel that a lot of the potential in the market is really about getting a big ball to move? Is it just that starting the public to really accept things, and then a huge amount of the potential will be then unleashed? And has that ball started moving for you?
It will still take time. I think the first, from 2010 to 2020, that's been the first really decade of insect booming, just to people are starting to be aware, and this decade for 2020 to 2030 will be real the reality of the insect product in human food. It's already a reality in pet food and fish feed and plant fertilizer, as I mentioned. But for human food, it will really come now. And we really think that sports nutrition and health nutrition, like elderly nutrition, are the best way to start with technical ingredients. functional ingredients with strong benefits, sustainability and health. But, and again, it's not hidden, it's coming from insects, but it's not why people will buy the products. It's because the products are good and they have benefits. And it will start just to consumer to get used to this idea of eating insects as this processed meal.
Yeah.
And then they will, the next step will be to go not on technical aspect and this kind of performance, but to the core of the plate and about taste and really a meat complement or dairy complement or whatever, the new alternatives you can bring to the market to really grow much more the overall potential. But we need to start with some niche. It's not so small. And sports nutrition is 30 billion in the world. It's not a small niche like we could imagine, but it's the best way to enter, to get the people used to the thing that insects start to be in the shelves, in the retail, where they can start to be used to see it for real. And they start to also to see it for their pets. They start to see it on the salmon they buy, that they will be written fed by an insect. So they will get overall more and more in the next few years on the idea of insects.
And just one thing I'm really interested in is you've taken a huge round of investment, and you know your investors have really thrown themselves at this task. What was the thing that convinced them? Because with an issue like insects, you can throw as many spreadsheets and profit and loss projections at your investors as possible, but there's something in their bones that will shift them to actually making that move. What do you think was the thing that really grabbed them?
It was a combination of the product and the technology we have. Again, the products, we were the only one to prove with science, independent universities, health benefits, nutritional growth benefits, like fishing growing 30% faster, 40% less mortality. So it's a huge value for farmers eventually, fish farmers, also crop farmers. So this is something never seen in the alternative protein landscape. So it was one strong value. Second is the technology, the fact that we can scale to a very large amount that is sufficient to deliver our markets where the demand is big, because fish and pets, the demand is clear and big. We could build, you know, we are building this huge plant, a farm in Amiens, north of France. We assess the market. We can build between 50 and 100 farms like this in the world, only for fish and pets markets. And the premium subsegment market we are addressing in the fish and the pets. So investors could see the huge target addressable market. They could see a perfect market fit between the products and this premium segment of these markets with a unique value, very different from the others. And this technology that is able to scale and make it at a cost competitive, to be at a good price with a sufficient good margin and everything protected. We have the 300 patents that makes a very strong basis to grow, not only mealworms, by the way, but much more insects there. And the demand was there because the 100 million contracts are really signed and booked with the quality, the price over time for this year to the next 3 years. So they had the visibility of the market, the huge size of the total possible markets, the good technology and the good market fits, the product fits, all together convince the investors and the banks.
Well, Antoine, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck with the future. It sounds like really exciting times for you. And I hope we meet again and have another chat about this.
Yeah, thanks, Stefan. And welcome anytime to visit our farms in France and Netherlands and soon in the US.
Excellent. Picture the scene. It's the League of Legends 2019 World Championships. 36 cities hosting a 5-week tournament watched by 44 million people. The top player, Sang-Hyuk Lee, wins over $800,000. It's safe to say that esports is no longer a niche market. Esports is estimated to be worth over $1 billion, and these players need to be at their mental and physical peak to be successful. To get to that peak, they're using nutritional supplements. Now, joining me to discuss this are in this fascinating new area of nutrition, Francisca Dolla, Product and Account Manager, Health and Nutrition at Gelita. Hello, Francisca.
Hello, Stefan.
What makes esports an important market for supplement manufacturers like Gelita?
As you mentioned before, the esports market is booming, and manufacturers of functional foods and also nutritional supplements can tap into a new audience here. And for Gelita especially, it's a great opportunity to show the benefits of collagen peptides in the esports nutrition, and also to support the individual lifestyle needs in this sport discipline.
And what are the best formats for products for esports people?
You know, the nice thing about collagen is that collagen peptides are versatile applicable. They can be the base for any high protein concept in esports nutrition, starting, for example, from bars to RTDs to shots, sachets, but also gummies and functional foods are possible to formulate with collagen peptides. And all these formats need to be convenient for the gamers, and they need to fit into their daily routine. And all these formats are possible with bioactive collagen peptides because they deliver benefits at a relatively low and safe daily dose, which is usually between 2.5 and 15 grams per day. And this is crucial for successful finished products and also for the consumer's compliance in the end. But it's also important to note here that not all collagen peptides are created equally and that they don't share the same scientific substantiation and credibility, and that also gamers need to have a look at which collagen they choose. And I'd like to add here something, because esports is a sporting activity, and this was already proven by the German Sports University of Cologne, because they discovered that the amount of cortisol, and you mentioned Lewis Hamilton, so the amount of cortisol that is produced in gamers is about the same as that is found in race car drivers. And furthermore, they also discovered that the pulse rates of esport athletes sometimes are as high as 160 to 180 beats per minute. And this is equivalent to a marathon runner. And I think this is really, really impressive. So we can see, to perform at any level, especially in an esport arena, also in everyday life settings, like at home, at school, and so on, the body requires a proper fuel. And modern consumers, like gamers, athletes, active people, they know that nutrition is so much more than just maintaining healthy weight and body composition. They also know more and more that it's also to improve their performance.
So, Francesca, how's Gelita looking to shape this market over the next 5 years? Because obviously, it's a huge developing market of people that maybe also didn't think so much about nutrition before they started esports. What's your approach to this going to be?
As we mentioned before, in esports, the repetitive use of a keyboard and also a controller and a mouse can cause tendon and ligament problems and also long-term joint problems. And beside neck and back problems, one issue that is often causing pain, for example, in the forearm of gamers and in the thumb, is called gamer thumb. And here the role of collagen and also Gelita comes into play, because if I can just quickly say what collagen is the most abundant protein in our body. And it is the main component of the white tissue. And the white tissue you can find in ligaments, in tendons, in the cartilage, in your bones. And this white tissue is literally what holds our body together. And Gelita will inform about the importance of the white tissue. And as you know, Gelita is number one in collagen research. So it's not a secret if I say that we are more and more also exploring new health areas, also the area of immunity, the area of endurance, and that our research into collagen peptides shows no signs of slowing down. So here we will for sure come up with science. And furthermore, we are always continuously working on new concepts and innovative solutions. And also we try to further improve the technological properties of our products, for example, to include them in bars. We have a new product which bar manufacturers can use to increase the protein content of their bars up to 60%. And of course, we will also further work together with our testimonials. So we look into the market and we look for individual and personalized solutions backed up by science for this very interesting and specific target group.
I'm joined by experts from Givaudan. We have Nicole Olhaven, Senior Project Manager for Consumer Sensory Insights, EAME.
Hi, Steph.
Now, I'm sure that many of our listeners, because so many of them are in the food industry, they will have heard of the term umami, but let's dig a bit deeper. So, Nicole, it's still a little bit confusing, isn't it? We don't really have, certainly in Great Britain, we don't have the lexicon to describe it, but can you give us a bit more background on umami?
Yeah, I can actually. It's pretty much since the same time than what Mark just said, since about 1985, that umami has been known officially in the sensory world as one of the fifth basic tastes, together with sweet, sour, bitter, and salty. And I guess every one of us, we have heard about these four. But umami is still something we kind of like, we hear, we know a little bit, but we don't really understand. And I try to explain, like I would explain maybe to someone who has never experienced it by himself. Umami is actually enhancing flavor, and what it does, it's pretty easy to explain. You imagine you're taking a sip of water in your mouth, and suddenly that sip of water actually doesn't taste like just a plain sip of water. You have the impression that like you're having something much more full, much more rich, much more round in your mouth, almost like you magically turned a sip of water into a bouillon, a soup product. And that's what umami is doing, actually. So it's making your product much nicer, much richer. Generally, you could also say that umami brings savoriness into food. It elevates the natural profile. So it doesn't change the profile from chicken to beef. It actually just elevates the natural profile of a food product to a more complex and culinary level and makes it taste great. And this fact that it helps making product taste great is fantastic, and is also the reason why it is so important for the food industry. We know from various consumer research that we have run in our department that a great taste is the most important driver for consumers when they are buying a food product. And I guess we are all agreeing that we want products and food to taste great. So when we did an online study in 2018, for instance, we have seen actually that 87% of the consumers in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East are considering taste or also flavor as the most important driver when choosing a savory product. And in fact, only 79% consider health benefits as an important factor. So that speaks for itself. It's all about taste. And specifically, I think I would like to highlight that this is specifically true also for the younger generation of consumers, which are the millennials, and even younger than millennials, the Generation Z consumers. They are showing a very high interest and above the average of the other slightly older consumers in bold and intense flavors. They are almost craving for a taste explosion, you could also say. And also, I think what is important to keep in mind is that these generations, they generally, they would actually live a much more health conscious lifestyle. So you would imagine that they put health above taste, but in fact, that's not true. They are really not willing to compromise on taste at all.
Glad to hear.
Yeah, me too. In fact, I'm really a foodie, so I'm happy to hear that. Yeah. And we've seen that also earlier this year, where we in fact tested some of our umami solutions in the UK in a consumer test, and we were testing actually our solutions against pure MSG or products, not pure MSG, of course, but products containing MSG. And we were a bit like afraid, like really hoping that our solutions would perform equally or even better compared to a taste impression that is so much engraved in consumers' brains. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we were really surprised seeing that specifically those solutions which were performing extremely high and well in the impact and the complexity were the ones which were specifically liked by the consumers, by the UK consumers.
And it is bizarre that it's so difficult to put words to describe it. And so some people think, well, if you can't describe it, is it really there? But the neural pathways which deliver this information to the brain have been mapped, and the action of the taste receptors has proved that it is a separate taste. And if you look at Japanese food, the basis of so many Japanese dishes is a stock called dashi. And that is basically full of various different ingredients which have huge amounts of naturally occurring glutamates. You were talking about using water as a water metaphor to describe the mouthfeel. I sometimes say, just think of Parmesan. Basically, Parmesan is pretty, it's not really cheese you're grating on your pasta. It's pure umami.
it's more than just cheese, right?
Yeah, and rich hams and anyway. So Nicole, how would you describe the taste of umami? I know some people have said, well, think about it as somewhere in between salt and sweet, but that doesn't quite crack it, does it?
No, and it's in fact actually quite a tricky question because umami, and I think we all heard it a little bit already by the comments we just made. Umami is very complex. One of the classic references for umami is MSG, so the monosodium glutamate, but because this one produces really a very succulent and death flavor when you are using it in your dishes, when you're cooking with it. But when you're actually tasting MSG or other ingredients like the ribonucleotides, you would definitely say that it's something of a little bit, it has a little bit of everything. It's a bit salt, it's a bit sweet, but it's also a bit acidic and mineral. So it would be unfair to say, in fact, that it's a combination of the four basic tastes, because umami is unique and it makes it so difficult to describe. And because it's somehow subtle, but not, it's can be maybe best linked to like what we said, like a chicken stock that you have cooked at home, that you were cooking for hours, maybe some cheese, mushroom, we heard it already, but it's really, really difficult. And from a sensory perspective, it's also very hard to describe umami with just a single descriptor. That's not possible. We actually need a large number of various descriptors to be able to describe this complex taste perception. And it goes from what we said, it goes from the salt, the acidity, the mineral elements, sometimes even up to the level of some mouse feel descriptors that are used to describe what umami does in a food product. And also, I think when talking about umami, and we have realized that also throughout last year when we did a massive study internally at Givaudan using our expert panels describing our umami solutions, we could not stop at that kind of like factual level. We also had to integrate more holistic descriptors, which were looking at how is the balance, the impact, the longevity of a product that contains umami compounds.
So there's a bit of poetry in there as well. I love this. I love the idea of that. There's a sort of, because flavor and descriptions of flavor tend to be so technical. I love the idea that it's really hard to describe because you have to draw on so many other elements to be able to explain it.
Absolutely. I think it's absolutely this. And I think it's at the end, it's the full harmony and balance of all of these different elements, which are making actually a product taste delicious. And if something goes out of control, then probably the result, even though it would still have umami, could also go outside of what you wanted to achieve. Yeah. So it's really about the balance of all of these different elements.
We're joined by Matthias Bordeaux, Marketing Manager, Texturizers, Cargill.
Hello.
What dairy alternatives are we talking about? And is it really a growing market?
Yeah, so I think a couple of years back, we would have been talking mainly about alternatives to milk and then mainly soy milk. That's definitely changed. So now the market is not just those alternative drinks, but it's also things like alternatives to cheese, to ice cream, to yogurts and desserts, even to creamers and so on. Is it a growing market? Definitely. If we look at the forecast for the next 5 years in terms of value There's a forecast of up to 20% of compound annual growth rate, meaning that in the next 5 years, the expectation is that the market will grow by 20% every year. So that's definitely massive. Is it big or not? Well, if you would sum up dairy and dairy alternatives as just one category, the value share of dairy alternatives should be around 7% by 2025. So I let you judge whether that's big or small. I mean, the evolution is, like I was saying, in the fact that it's not just anymore about the dairy alternative drinks. In fact, we're seeing soy drinks stagnate a little bit over time. Dairy alternative drinks still make up about 80% of the global turnover of the dairy alternative market. But we're seeing, like I was saying, a host of other dairy alternative applications popping up. And those applications grow at a much, much higher rate than milk alternatives. And so if you look at things like, the non-dairy cheeses, the non-dairy ice creams, non-dairy yogurts, your non-dairy desserts, all of these, especially in Europe and the US, you see every year innovations doubling. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of market activity and a lot of excitement around this market.
So is this still a niche market? Would you consider it niche or is it really going mainstream now?
I think it's definitely fair to say it's going mainstream. We had a study done recently where we found that more than 40% of European shoppers consume both dairy and dairy alternatives. So many of us, we have both products in our fridges. And there's just a couple of percent of consumers who say they only have or they only consume dairy alternative products. You know, in recent years, dairy consumers have just become more open to try new things. You know, we've seen that with consumers embracing things like quark or skyr and all kinds of other products. And it's also the market itself, so the producers themselves trying to diversify a little bit and just add new products into the market. So it's both, you know, consumers asking for more diversity in dairy products, and it's also manufacturers bringing more dairy alternatives to diversify their own offer. The interesting thing is about dairy alternatives and the health perception. I think, you know, whereas if you look at meat alternatives there, it's quite clear that consumers are drawn to alternatives to meat mostly because of health concerns. With dairy, it's not necessarily that strong because consumers generally have a good perception of dairy and health. Now, having said that, we still, in that same study that we did, found about 4 out of 10 consumers who did think you can have a balanced diet without consuming animal-based dairy. And so to the extent that dairy alternative brands could play more on health benefits or expand their health benefits on their products, I think they would be able to win even more consumers over.
What do you think will be the challenges of tomorrow? Let's put your future gazing specs on and tell us about what the future holds.
Right, Stefan. Well, I think I've alluded it already at some of it in the beginning of our talk. I think as the industry resolves that initial taste and texture challenge, the next challenges will be on making the end products more label friendly and on improving, especially on the nutritional aspects. I mean, today, all those vegan, vegetarian, plant-based labels in consumers' minds are associated with healthy products, right? And they may not yet be getting the same scrutiny that some of the dairy products are getting in terms of the ingredient list that's on the back of pack. But I think as they'll become more mainstream, it won't be long before consumers do take an interest into the ingredient list, and I think a lot of them are already doing that. And are asking questions about how many ingredients does this product have? Does it need to have this many ingredients? What's, you know, the level of processing of those ingredients and so on? I think you obviously have a lot of formulations where a lot of different ingredients are combined. So today, you know, it's still difficult to answer that question. But in the not so distant future, we're really going to have to work on that aspect of, you know, the label friendliness of those products. The other thing to look out for is, of course, in continental Europe, there's a lot of countries where we're now seeing the introduction of the Nutri-Score. which is a system to rate products in terms of their nutrition, from A being the best product to E being the worst product in terms of nutrition. There's a lot of questions around it, whether that's the right way to do it, but a lot of retailers are using that Nutri-Score already today in continental Europe. Of course, in the UK, you've got your traffic light system. So what that does to the flexitarian consumer who now compares the original, let's say, real dairy product with the dairy alternative, you know, that gives him or her really a comparison. And in many cases, the dairy alternative product doesn't come out too well in that comparison. So I think we're going to see a lot of drive into label-friendly and plant-based, more protein-enriched products, more products with high fiber content, and a lot of, you know, communication around that on the packs of those products. It could also play out in other ways, like you'll probably have more blends of different proteins so that you get, you know, to the best functionality and nutritional level. And that can be a blend of different plant-based proteins to get to that. But it could also be, and we're seeing that already in the States, hybrids of both animal protein and plant-based protein. And then you can really get to a point where you get to a higher protein content, but also the desired sugar level. You're still lowering the animal-based protein content, but you're kind of maintaining the taste. So that's something that's very, very interesting. So, yeah, it's clean label, nutrition, sustainability, and they're all elements that, you know, as Cargill, we're also working on and we're ready to support our customers on.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.